Lawmakers have spent a lot of time lately debating what to do about the country's growing deficit. In doing so, they're wrestling with a question that goes back to the beginning of the republic. What should the government spend its money on? Well, fear not, there is actually consensus among most economists on at least two things they say governments should pay for: lighthouses and probably autopsies. David Kestenbaum of our Planet Money team reports.
Lighthouses are the classic example of what economists call a public good.
Public good is something that we all need that will make our lives better, but that the market will not and cannot provide.
This is Charlie Whelan. He teaches public policy at the University of Chicago. Think about lighthouses, he says. If the government doesn't build lighthouses, where would the money come from? Sure, someone could go around to ship's captains and say, "Hey, we're going to build a lighthouse. Want to contribute?" But people will just say, no thanks, I don't need one. I'm a good sailor.
And you're just going to use our lighthouse without paying for it, because we can't do any, you know, we can't say close your eyes when you sail past this rocky point. With every other good, if you don't pay for it, if you don't buy the sneakers at Walmart, you just don't get to walk with them out of the store. And if you do, we'll arrest you. We can't do that for a lighthouse.
That seems like a sound argument, but we did some checking anyway. Okay, Jeff, give us some name and credentials.
Jeff Gales, U.S. Lighthouse Society Executive Director.
Jeff Gales says this is basically right. There were some privately built lighthouses. Then, in 1789, the government set up what would become the U.S. Lighthouse Service.
Prior to the establishment of the U.S. Lighthouse Service, I mean, you didn't have lighthouses on rocky shoals or in the middle of the ocean. I mean, those are places where it was really expensive to build.
So, general agreement on lighthouses. Also, most economists would agree, it makes sense for governments to pay for a military, since that won't arise on its own. Ditto with a court system. Charlie Whelan says some unexpected things also count as public goods, like autopsies.
The Journal of the American Medical Association has been arguing for 15 years, at least, that there's a public health problem because we're not doing enough autopsies. The autopsy rate has plummeted from 40-some percent down to, I think, single digits.
If we had more autopsies, we'd know more about how people die. So collectively, we all want them. And yet, no individual really has an incentive to pay for one. They don't see the benefit.
There's none for the person being autopsied. It's a little late for that.
The family thinks, yuck, autopsy, which leaves the doctor. But think about it from the doctor's perspective.
Best case, what you find in the autopsy confirms the diagnosis. And yes, I was right. This turns out it was this kind of cancer and so on. It turns out to be extremely common, much more than you would think, that there were either undiagnosed conditions, misdiagnosed conditions. So this person, best case, he was right. Worst case, he's going to be looking at malpractice. So the person who is in the best position to encourage autopsy often will not.
So you'd argue this is basically a lighthouse.
This is a lighthouse.
Charlie Whelan did find one private company that does autopsies, so we called 1-800-AUTOPSY. We got Vidal Herrera, the founder.
The American people are our customers. Anytime a death occurs, they don't have anybody do an autopsy, they can call it 1-800-AUTOPSY and we will help them.
But even Herrera agrees the government should be paying for autopsies. So there, we now have the beginning of an economist-approved list of things the government should be doing. Autopsies, lighthouses, courts, defense. But then Whelan says we get to the hard questions. How much for defense? What about healthcare, education? Those don't meet the strict definitions of public goods, but most governments end up getting involved with them anyway. David Kestenbaum, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Ally Bank, offering sleeping money alerts to notify customers when their money could be doing more. Learn more at allybank.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz.
And I'm Melissa Block. A lot of Democrats have problems with the big tax deal President Obama made with Republicans. They don't like the extension of Bush-era tax cuts for the wealthy. They don't like the provision on the estate tax. And some Democrats are getting heartburn over the proposed reduction in Social Security taxes. As NPR's John Idstey reports, they worry it could seriously weaken the program.
The Social Security piece of the controversial tax package seems like something most taxpayers would welcome. Every worker who pays the Social Security payroll tax would get to pocket an additional 2% of their salary instead of sending it to Social Security. The maximum benefit would be a little over $2,000, and the tax break would expire after 1 year. President Obama seemed pretty pleased with the provision when he described it in a news conference on Tuesday.
As a result of this agreement, we will cut payroll taxes in 2011, which will add about $1,000 to the take-home pay of a typical family. So this isn't an abstract debate. This is real money for real people.
It's a good deal for the American people, said the president. But the payroll tax makes Nancy Altman very nervous.
This could eventually lead to the unraveling of Social Security.
Altman, who co-chairs the advocacy group Social Security Works, says it might look like a harmless one-year boost for struggling Americans. But Altman is certain Republicans will try to make the payroll tax cut permanent, which she says could lead to trouble for Social Security.
The Bush tax cuts were supposed to be 10 years. And we see now that it's very hard once the tax cut is in place to repeal it. The fear is that once this cut is made, it becomes permanent, and all of a sudden Social Security's shortfall, which is very manageable at this point, would actually double.
Now, under the one-year deal hatched by President Obama and Republican lawmakers, Social Security's long-term financial problems would not worsen. That's because the retirement program's trust fund would be reimbursed for its lost tax receipts. The money would come out of general revenues, the same pot that pays for things like food stamps and defense. But Altman and some Democratic lawmakers worry that if the payroll tax becomes permanent, Congress will balk at making up the shortfall year after year with general revenues. Here's Congressman Ted Deutsch, a Florida Democrat.
If we start to fund Social Security through general revenue, given where we are today, through deficit spending, it will permit those who would like to move away from our longstanding successful Social Security program to privatization and to benefit cuts. It will enable them to make those arguments in a way that they've never been able to make them before.
Deutsch says he has no doubt that a year from now, some Republicans will try to make the payroll tax cut permanent. Republican Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee is predicting the same thing. He says that a year from now, when the tax break expires, it'll be portrayed as a tax increase. And Republican Senator Mike Johanns of Nebraska agrees.
I anticipate that somewhere along the line, somebody's going to make that argument, whether I agree with it or not.
In any case, Johanns warns against, quote, messing with Social Security.
We've got to get back to the reality that this is a system that needs our thoughtful consideration and how best to improve it.
There's no question that the White House understood it was taking a risk, but the administration couldn't convince Republicans to renew a stimulus program targeted at lower-income workers. So, with the economy continuing to struggle, the White House opted to embrace the stimulus provided by the Social Security tax cut and worry about the repercussions a year from now. John Idstey, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Guy Raz. The congressional battle over tax cuts is just heating up, but President Obama is already looking ahead to next year. That's when he wants to, in his words, start a conversation about a broader rewrite of the tax code. And as NPR's Scott Horsley reports, a bipartisan group of senators is urging him on.
President Obama has talked about his desire to rewrite the nation's tax code several times this week, in a White House news conference, during a photo op with the Polish president, and finally during an interview with NPR's Morning Edition.
Typically, the idea is simplifying the system, hopefully lowering rates, broadening the base. That's something that I think most economists think would help us propel economic growth. But it's a very complicated conversation.
The president has not explicitly linked this idea to the more immediate argument over extending Bush-era tax cuts, but a bipartisan group of senators wants to do just that. Virginia Democrat Mark Warner has been talking with about 20 of his colleagues, both Democrats and Republicans. They want to include a call for tax reform and deficit reduction when the Senate considers the president's tax cut compromise next week.
We've got to demonstrate, as the Congress, that we can walk and chew gum at the same time. There's a lot of members that, while they may end up supporting the president's compromise, also feel that here's a good time to indicate that next year we are going to come back and take up the really hard task of tax reform and deficit reduction.
Warner says lawmakers should do more than just talk about tax reform. They should actually vote on a plan next year.
Well, I don't think we have the luxury of waiting. Punting this issue into the 2012 presidential debate may be a recipe for inaction.
For now, at least, the president is not setting such an aggressive timeline, noting that past efforts at tax reform have generally taken a long time.
What I believe is that we've got to start that conversation next year. I think we can get some broad bipartisan agreement that it needs to be done, but it's going to require a lot of hard work to actually make it happen.
The last big tax overhaul took place a quarter century ago, after several years of legislative groundwork. Former New Jersey Senator Bill Bradley was a key player in that effort. He and his colleagues eventually succeeded in meeting Democrats' demands to eliminate tax loopholes and Republican calls for lower tax rates.
And the result is, I think, you get overall fairness, simplicity, and efficiency in the system.
Since that last big house cleaning, lawmakers have made thousands of changes to the tax code, adding new loopholes and deductions that cost the government close to $1 trillion a year. Meanwhile, tax rates have gone up again. Still, Bradley says the 86 overhaul shows it's possible to weed out tax breaks and achieve a simpler, better tax code.
Sometimes legislators can surprise the public by doing something that the pundits thought was never possible.
That 86 rewrite took place when one party controlled the White House and Senate, and the other party ran the House. That will be the case again starting next month. Scott Horsley, NPR News, the White House.
Foreign markets are an important part of GM's future. One new market that could soon open to GM and the other U.S. automakers is South Korea. The two countries have reached a free trade deal. The Obama administration says if Congress approves the pact, it could create tens of thousands of new jobs. NPR's Sonari Glinton reports.
Let's get an understanding of how lopsided trade is between the U.S. and South Korea right now. Take cars, for example. Last year, South Korean carmakers sold about 500,000 vehicles in the U.S. In South Korea, the U.S. car company sold 6,000. 500,000 to 6,000. That's just one of the imbalances the U.S.-Korea trade agreement seeks to correct.
It could have an economic impact that is larger than the last 9 free trade agreements entered into by the United States.
That was U.S. Trade Representative Ron Kirk. He says the trade deal would create a minimum of 70,000 U.S. jobs, and it would touch almost every area of commerce. The key sticking point, though, has always been the auto industry. Sean McAlinden is with the Center for Automotive Research. He says until recently, the South Koreans have kept their auto market locked up tight.
There was a point not too long ago that if you bought an import of any kind, that guaranteed you a federal tax audit. That would obviously prevent a lot of import sales.
McAlinden says South Korea has been under tremendous pressure to open its markets to trade, and recently it has. The South Koreans have already signed a free trade deal with the European Union and 8 other countries. And with its huge middle class, McAlinden says South Korea is a market Detroit must tap.
Sales growth in the auto industry, the United States and Europe, is essentially stagnant. The growth in the next 20 years will be almost entirely in the developing world or in the new markets.
The 3 Detroit car companies agree. So do top Republicans in Congress. The United Auto Workers Union is backing the plan because of major concessions won for the auto industry. Other unions, like the Steelworkers Union, say they've been left out in the cold. Thea Lee is with the AFL-CIO, the nation's largest labor organization. She says this is just the latest in the long string of bad trade deals.
It's an economically significant deal with a very powerful exporting country, and we didn't do enough to protect American jobs.
Lee says while the auto industry may be helped by the deal, the trade pact will only encourage U.S. manufacturers to move to South Korea in the race to find cheaper wages.
The companies are mobile. They can move production all around the world. They can make money wherever they are. American workers have to make a living on American soil, and so we need a different kind of trade agreement than a lot of the multinational corporations, and that's really the dividing point.
Recent polls have shown Americans increasingly skeptical of free trade, but the administration and congressional Republicans say approving the Korean trade deal will be a top priority in the new year. Sonari Glinton, NPR News, Washington.